welcome to The Morning Mix. This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio for Friday, April 27th, 2012. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. Today's show, British Petroleum or Blatant Propaganda, the impact of the Deepwater Horizon's disaster on health 2 years on. We speak with two of today's most hard-hitting independent journalists to bring you the truth about what's going on in the Gulf of Mexico. First, we'll hear an interview with investigative journalist Dar Jamal and his recent reports on BP and the oily ecocide that continues to unfold. At the bottom of the hour, it's Steve Zeltzer with Workweek Radio. And we conclude today's broadcast in discussion with investigative journalist Antonio Yuhas about her most recent reporting published in The Nation magazine. 2 years after the BP spill, a hidden health crisis festers. Please stay with us. Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. Today's program, we focus on BP and the impact of the Deepwater Horizon disaster. It's been a little over 2 years since a drilling rig explosion in the Gulf of Mexico killed 11 workers and touched off the worst marine oil disaster in history. The damaged BP well began spewing oil April 20, 2010. 3 months would pass before the well was finally capped in mid-July after nearly 5 million barrels of oil polluted the Gulf of Mexico. Federal authorities declared the well, quote, officially dead 2 months after that, but there have been reports of ongoing seepage of oil into the ocean, and our two guests today are going to talk about that, Dar Jamal and Antonia Yuhas. But we wanted to begin here by talking a little bit about some of the very immediate aftermath of what was happening with the BP gusher in the Gulf. Was a scramble to control and frame the language of how it was being discussed. And we wrote about this in the Censored 2011 book in the news abuse chapter. I co-authored with a few people, including Adam Bessie, an English professor at Diablo Valley College. And Bessie wrote at length about how British Petroleum was really struggling to frame and censor essentially their complicity in this massive disaster. The corporate media did very little to investigate what has happened and has really done very little follow-up. And just to show you how much of an effort BP made to control the debate, even left progressive publications, many of them, refer to the BP disaster in the Gulf of Mexico as the Gulf oil spill, or the oil spill, or the Gulf Coast spill. That's a linguistic coup for corporations like BP because their name is literally off of the page there for people to even consider their culpability. In fact, there was arguably more scrubbing of BP's culpability from the corporate media than there was oil being scrubbed from the beaches, where journalists were threatened with up to $20,000 fines for trying to report things that were going on down on along the Gulf of Mexico. So at any rate, Peter Phillips, you would like to say a few things also about BP executives and cover-ups.
Well, what's been revealed most recently is Greg Palast's story about how BP was drilling in the Caspian Sea and had a very similar blowout 2 years earlier. That they, in fact, if had they revealed that and had they changed their procedures, would have prevented the Deepwater Horizon explosion in the Gulf. But this was covered up. Greg Palast went to Abidjan. They were actually kicked out of the country. But then secret memos that were released through WikiLeaks declared that the cables confirmed that BP had a serious blowout. The cause was the same as the Gulf disaster 2 years earlier, that the cement mud used to cap the wells had failed. And had they acknowledged this at that point and not covered it up, we would likely not have seen the disaster that happened in the Gulf. And this is Robert F. Kennedy Jr. calls this cover-up criminal.
That's right. And again, British Petroleum, in the aftermath of the, again, this massive ecocide taking place in the Gulf of Mexico, BP spent $50 million on a PR campaign designed to shape the way the public thinks and speaks about the company by controlling Google search terms. So again, mass investment in the cover up of this incredible disaster. And it's ongoing. It's 2 years later. There are still many problems going on in the Gulf of Mexico, and we're hearing very little about them. But today on the Project Censored Show, we're going to focus on what those issues are, what those problems are. Recently, Project Censored producer Anthony Fest got to speak with Al Jazeera correspondent and independent journalist Dar Jamal, who's done extensive reporting on BP. Dar Jamal is based in Qatar. He works as an online news producer for Al Jazeera English. His stories have been published with Interpress Service, Truthout, The Nation, several publications around the world. His dispatches and news stories have been translated into numerous languages, and again, he appears on many alternative media outlets. His reporting has earned him numerous awards, including several Project Censored awards. This is the interview done yesterday between Anthony Fest and Dar Jamal.
Dar Jamal, welcome to the Project Censored Report.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
So, summarize for us, 2 years after the start of the BP spill, what's the condition of the Gulf?
We have scientific reports that show that it's estimated approximately 75% of the oil remains in deep sea plumes. We're seeing massive impacts on sea life and seafood. We see shrimp and crabs and fish with lesions and deformities. There are now eyeless shrimp that are being caught out both inshore and offshore, which is very disturbing because one of the qualities of the dispersants, as well as some of the chemicals in crude oil, which let's remember this is a hazardous material in and of itself, some of the qualities of the chemicals are that they're mutagenic. And it seems to be affecting shrimp more quickly because shrimp only have an average lifespan of approximately 1 year. So we're looking at the second and in some cases even third generation of shrimp now since the oil spill occurred. And so it's had time for these chemicals to get into their genetic makeup. And so we're seeing eyeless shrimp. We're seeing shrimp with tumors, other deformities, eyeless dolphins, crabs that are runt crabs, crabs with scorch marks and almost like chemical burn-like marks on their shells, crabs without claws, and then incidents of fish lesions, which let's be clear, fish lesions did exist before the spill, but only at an incidence, according to the scientists that I spoke with from LSU, only at a naturally occurring incidence of 0.1% of red snapper sample did have lesions. Now, post-spill, we're looking at between 2 and 5% of all red snapper sample. That's a 2 to 5,000% increase.
So to sum up what the scientists are finding, widespread deformities in sea creatures up and down the food chain.
That's right. As I said, we're seeing deformities in, and I use the term seafood specifically because, of course, it's given that this is sea life. But I use seafood specifically because BP has been claiming, especially in a massive propaganda push around this two-year anniversary, that the seafood is fine, everything's great, the Gulf's open for business, tourism, it's going to be another great year, come on down and eat the seafood. And I focused a lot of my reporting in on the seafood specifically, so we're talking about shrimp, crab, red snapper, other things that are being directly impacted by these chemicals, because all is not well in the Gulf of Mexico, and we are seeing seafood, things that people are harvesting out of the ocean to catch and eat, that is not safe. But you know, if you listen to BP and the U.S. federal government, agencies like the Food and Drug Administration and the so-called Environmental Protection Agency, everything's safe to eat. It's been thoroughly tested. And actually, EPA and FDA both have gone out of their way and stated, and I'm not making this up, they have said that seafood is just as safe now in the Gulf of Mexico as it was prior to BP's oil disaster. So, you know, basically, a two-year-old could probably figure out that when you inject nearly 5 million barrels of oil into the Gulf of Mexico and also 1.9 million gallons of toxic dispersant, so toxic that it's banned in 19 other countries, including the UK, that it's really just not logical that seafood would be just as good now as it was before the storm. We're seeing direct impact in these deformities that seem to be increasing.
You've summarized some of the conversations you've had with scientists who are studying the impact of the spill on the Gulf, and the fishing industry is operating again. What have fishermen told you about the changes in sea life since the disaster?
It's fishermen. That's how I came upon this story in the first place, talking to fishermen and fisherwomen and seafood processors as well. They were the people who provided us with the samples of the Isla shrimp that we took photos of, and that's when we decided to really dive into this story. Another seafood processor, Keith Ladner, out of Biloxi, Mississippi, he provided me photos with shrimp he had with tumors in their heads and lots of other really nasty pictures of deformities in both white and brown shrimp alike. And it's the fisher people themselves that were telling me, look, we're pulling up crab traps that are covered in oil.
This is Anthony Fest with the Project Censored Report. I'm speaking with Dar Jamail, Al Jazeera correspondent who's covered the Gulf oil spill since it happened 2 years ago. Dar, we've talked about the nearly 5 million barrels of oil that escaped into the Gulf, but as well as that, as you mentioned, nearly 2 million gallons of chemicals were spread into the water from boats or aircraft. These chemicals are called dispersants, as that name implies. They were intended to break up the oil slick. In other words, for every barrel of oil, there was nearly a half gallon of dispersant chemical poured into the ocean. But what is the chemical composition of dispersants, and what effect have they had on the environment of the Gulf region?
Well, off the top of my head, I can't tell you the exact chemical composition of the dispersants, but I do know that so that people have a rough idea of what these are composed of, they're basically an industrial solvent. So they have things like naphthalene and benzene and other chemicals in them that cause, when taken together, the dispersants are mutagenic, teratogenic, and carcinogenic. So very, very nasty stuff. It's not exactly the dish soap that people like Mississippi Governor Haley Barbour like to claim that they were. These are extremely toxic chemicals. They are banned in 19 countries, including the UK, but for whatever reason, they are okay to use in U.S. Waters.
It was BP who actually put them into the ocean, not the government officials, correct?
Well, BP had to have the okay from the U.S. Coast Guard and the Environmental Protection Agency. So this is technically a foreign company operating in U.S. waters. And even if it was a U.S. company, if they're going to use a chemical dispersant like this, they have to have permission from the U.S. Coast Guard as well as the Environmental Protection Agency. And the U.S. Coast Guard had basically given them a blank check as far as, hey, look, you guys use as much of this as you need to use. And the EPA as well. At one point, when it became clear how toxic these chemicals are, there was a lot of ruckus raised when BP was using so much of it so early on in the disaster. And so under public pressure, the EPA came down on BP and said, look, you guys need to stop using this stuff. And BP said no. And the EPA said, okay, well, they basically set up some more paperwork hoops that BP had to roll through. But at the end of the day, it was the Coast Guard that allowed them to go on and keep using this stuff. And the interesting thing is, according to the Coast Guard, since July 18, 2010, that no dispersants have been used, and yet we are still hearing claims from fishermen and Gulf residents that these types of chemicals are still being used both right up against the shore as well as offshore. So it's very, very disturbing. And a lot of the scientists I've spoken with believe that it's these chemicals, when combined with the chemicals in the oil itself, mixed, they actually create a more dangerous and a more toxic chemical than one or the other of those two elements by themselves.
We've been speaking about the effects on the environment, but what about the effects on the people who live and work on or near the Gulf coastline?
Both cleanup workers and fishermen and coastal residents are exhibiting the exact same symptoms. And so what these chemicals do to humans is they're neurotoxic. So people, they even cause dementia in people. They cause cardiovascular problems, respiratory problems, heart palpitations. And it's a very, very nasty impact on humans. They cause internal and external hemorrhaging. They cause extremely nasty rashes that have become so common across the Gulf Coast. They're referred to as the BP rash. So it's a really horrible situation for the people working there. And I've even spoken with people who claim that they know people who were involved in the oil cleanup and who have died from exposure to these chemicals. I've spoken with dozens of people who have literally gone and had their blood tested, and the chemicals from both BP's oil and in some cases even of the dispersants themselves have turned up in the bloodstream. It's called a metamatrix test. I've seen the paperwork for it, and there's dozens and dozens, if not hundreds of people now along the Gulf Coast that have understood what's happened. They live near the coast. They're being consistently exposed to these chemicals. Even now, 2 years after the spill, they're still being exposed to this stuff, and now they're struggling to get not just treatment, but, of course, compensation as well.
Are there any estimates of how many people are affected by these symptoms and conditions?
Well, the only really hard numbers that we can go on is the people who were either directly in the cleanup operation, which was called the Vessels of Opportunity Program, when BP hired all of the out-of-work fishermen and put them to work cleaning up oil. And we do know that there's roughly between 75 and 100,000 cleanup workers and volunteers that were engaged in this effort, and all of whom were exposed to some degree to these chemicals. Enough people and enough evidence has come of this that the National Institutes of Health has launched a 10-year study on tens of thousands of these people. I think their study is focusing on 55,000 individuals. But the problem is that hasn't resulted, at least to date, in government funding of setting up clinics. Theoretically, as part of the first $7.8 billion settlement, there is funding now to start setting up these clinics, but so far that's not happening. So that gives you an idea of at least some of the numbers that we're talking about. Upwards of 100,000 people that were directly involved in the cleanup, but then we could also include upwards of at least another 100,000 people who just live along the coast in the impacted areas. People living right on the coast or up to about a mile inland. So we're talking about, you know, it's pretty safe to say we're getting close to 250,000 people that we know have been directly impacted by these chemicals.
Now, we're speaking on Thursday, April 26th, and yesterday the federal judge hearing some of the lawsuits against BP and its co-defendants said he was leaning toward approving a settlement of slightly under $8 billion, although the final approval, if that happens, is still months away, and the case doesn't include everybody who's brought suit. Also, if there is a settlement, BP not only gets some closure on its financial responsibility, but it also avoids having various internal documents made public as evidence and its executives having to testify. So what do you think are some of the unanswered questions that a trial could shed light on?
You bring up a very important point, because I think BP's main goal right now is to avoid trial at all costs, because if they go to court and they're criminally negligent, the amount of fines that are going to be able to be levied against them under the Clean Water Act and in many other instances are really going to go through the roof. I mean, they're having to pay out an enormous amount of money already, but so far it's not nearly as much as they would have to pay out if they go to court and are found criminally negligent. And I think that is the first and foremost thing that I would point to, is the overt criminal negligence in their safety record, the things that they did, the things that they ignored that led up to this disaster on the Deepwater Horizon, the explosion, you know, them turning off alarms, ignoring alarms, cutting corners, rushing ahead with a job. All of this has been extremely well documented, and that, for starters, would be something they absolutely don't want to come out any more than it already has come out. also the fact that they have gone ahead and used these dispersants, which everyone in the oil industry understands how toxic these things really are. And not only did they use them, but more dispersants were used in this single oil disaster than have ever been used before. So they wouldn't want to come out the fact that they pushed to keep using these things despite the overwhelming evidence available that shows how toxic they are. These are two very important points. You know, that this goes to trial and more of this information comes out and more comes out about their negligence, not just in what led up to the disaster on the rig, but in the response, that knowing that, you know, it probably environmentally as well as from a human health perspective would have been a better situation had they just let all the oil come up to the surface and then skimmed it or burned it. And I'm not condoning burning, but compared to the dispersants, it may have well have even been a better thing to do. So these are just a couple of things that absolutely BP is not wanting to have this mountain of evidence, literally millions and millions of pages of evidence that's waiting to be brought against them if this thing does go to a trial.
And there was another legal development this week. The first criminal charges were brought against a BP employee. This was a former engineer who's accused of deleting about 100 text messages about the amount of oil that's leaking. Is this only the first of what should be many charges, or is this liable to stay where it is with that one individual?
They think this is likely the first of probably a string of individuals like this the Department of Justice is going to single out and start making examples of to show that they're very, very serious about trying to bring justice to BP for, you know, countless acts of negligence that they've done. I mean, this one case in particular really highlights what actually those of us who followed this, whether you're a journalist or just, you know, a news consumer on this specific topic, it was so clear from the very beginning that BP was all about trying to conceal and hide how big this disaster really was. I mean, we all remember the infamous remarks of then BP CEO Tony Hayward of saying, well, it's just a small amount of oil in a big ocean. That the first of countless gaffes that ended up causing BP to shuffle him off to a different position. But, you know, they at first even denied that there was any oil coming out at all. And then only after people from the Gulf Restoration Network went out there and saw massive swaths of oil, did they say, okay, it's 1,000 barrels a day, and then 5,000, and then 10. And then that's really what's evident in this engineer's text of him, you know, trying to hide how bad the situation really was. And so this is one specific example that really highlights BP's, you know, obviously the culture of trying to have everybody within the organization itself just, you know, minimize the safety concerns, minimize, of course, once the accident happens, how bad it really is. And, of course, that's a blatant obstruction of justice. And so I think you're right. I think this is just going to be one of probably a fairly sizable queue of people that we're going to see this happen to.
In the 2 minutes or so we have left, is there anything else you'd like to tell our listeners about the ongoing effects of the BP oil spill now 2 years old?
I think the main thought I would like to leave people with is just that, you know, yeah, it's been 2 years and that's a good amount of time, but if in an oil disaster this size, we are still in very early stages. Just keep in mind, on the other side of the Gulf of Mexico, the Bay of Campeche, Mexico, in 1979, there was the Ixtoc 1 blowout oil disaster, which wasn't even one-third the size of this. And to this day, we still have not had full recovery of the oyster and shrimp populations over in that area. The mangroves along the shore were decimated. You can go down to South Padre Island today and dig down a bit and still find oil from that. So we're looking at a very long-term situation of recovery here, and I'm afraid that the situation in the Gulf, we're going to see a lot more deleterious effects before we start seeing anything like recovery from this. So I think we still are in a stage where in the next few years we're going to see things continue to degrade and get worse before they start to turn around at all, unfortunately.
Okay, Dr. Mayle, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks, Anthony.
And this is Anthony Fest for the Project Censored Report.
Please stay with us. We're going to go to Steve Zelter's Work Week Radio now. But when we come back, we'll have an interview live with Antonio Juhasz, author of Black Tide, The Devastating Impact of the Gulf Oil Spill.
There's a flag unfurled in city streets across the world, and every bell in the city's rung, every freedom song that's yet unsung. We'll find a voice, we'll find a way to fill the air on the 1st of May.
Millions of workers, unionized and unorganized, are under a reign of terror in the workplace. Bosses and corporations are taking advantage of the mass unemployment to demand further concessions and cutbacks. Hundreds of thousands of California public workers, from state workers, city workers, and teachers, have had wage cuts with furloughs and givebacks. Many of these workers have lost their homes to the banks, who got bailed out by Obama and the Democratic Party leadership. Over 100,000 workers face contract expirations in Northern California, and the bosses are demanding that workers pay more for their health care, as well as taking cuts in their pensions and other benefits. Many of these corporations, such as Sutter Healthcare, AT&T, Westfield Center, and others, are taking a hard line against their workers, and there is a frontal assault on working people and unions throughout the country. Some AT&T CWA workers in San Jose and other Northern California cities have been suspended recently for wearing stickers saying WTF or Where's the Fairness? The fact is, there is no fairness and justice in this country. While the corporate crooks rob us blind, they get off with a slap on the wrist, while workers lose their jobs and are fired for standing up for their rights. Bankruptcy laws written by corporate lawyers have also been used to steal union pension funds from steel workers and airline workers, and most recently American airline workers, who picketed this past week at SFO and other airports around the country. Bankruptcy laws are also being used by cities throughout the country to void contracts and rip up the benefits of workers that have been won over many decades. In San Francisco, the Democratic Mayor Ed Lee wants further concessions from city workers, including furloughs and benefit cuts. This is after city workers have given hundreds of millions of dollars in concession bargaining. The mayor says that the city has to be business-friendly to get on a sound footing, and he has made it clear that the workers who keep the hospitals running, clean the buildings, and make the city work have to pay the cost of this crisis, while San Francisco's 16 billionaires and many millionaires are doing great in getting tax subsidies. Many workers are also fearful to stand up for their health and safety, even on union jobs. They are fearful of complaining about safety problems, while there is growing blatant discrimination against whistleblowers who expose health and safety discrimination, sex and race discrimination, and corruption. Following the 2006 historic immigrant worker May Day rallies of over a million workers throughout the United States, a massive police government attack took place on these workers and their families. This continues under President Obama, as hundreds of thousands of immigrant workers have been arrested and deported by ICE, breaking up their families and lives. This is the, quote, liberal, unquote, Democrat Obama. May Day started in Chicago in 1886 when workers fought for an eight-hour day. The leaders, who were anarchists and socialists, were framed up and hung, making them labor martyrs for all working people around the world. Many of these workers in Chicago were also immigrant workers who were fighting for worker rights. Today, management, both public and private, has laid down the gauntlet against the unions, and this coming May Day, some unions are taking direct action. The Golden Gate Bridge Labor Coalition workers, who have been working without a contract since last July, will be taking action on May Day with a rally at the bridge. Westfield janitors, SEIU 87, will be marching and rallying, and Sutter, Peralta nurses in Berkeley will be striking. Also, ILW Local 10 longshore workers will be shutting down the port for a stop work meeting on May Day. The need for unified working class action is critical. No union can fight alone, and all working people need to join together. This was one of the reasons for the San Francisco general strike. That strike broke the back of the shipping companies and police and the politicians' plans to bust the maritime unions. The general strike forced the employers to agree to a union hall and encouraged hundreds of thousands of other workers to join unions and fight for their rights. This history is now more relevant than ever as we commemorate May Day 2012 and join with workers around the world. This is Steve Zelter with Workweek Radio, and now we go to our calendar.
This is the Workweek calendar for the week of April 27th, 2012. Tonight, on Friday, April 27th, a new film, Brothers on the Line, about the UAW Reuther Brothers, will be screened at 7 o'clock p.m. at the Berkeley Fellowship of Unitarian Universalists Hall at 1924 Cedar, near Bonita. Sasha Reuther, the grandson of Victor Reuther, is the producer of the film and will be speaking. For more information about the Labor Film Festival, visit realwork.org, spelled R-E-E-L-W-O-R-K.org, or email laborstudies@att.net. Saturday, April 28th, is commemorated as Workers' Memorial Day around the world to commemorate workers who have been killed on the job and those injured in fighting for their health and safety and for health care. Millions of workers have been injured nationally on the job, and many have lost their health care benefits, families, and homes. California, under Schwarzenegger, deregulated workers' comp, and this cut permanent disability benefits by 50% and made it very difficult for seriously injured workers to get care. The commemoration will show a film called Before Their Time about cancer in the workplace, and there will be speakers. The event will take place at the San Francisco Bernal Library at 500 Cortlandt Street at 2:30 p.m. For more information, visit workersmemorialday.org. On Monday, April 30th, San Francisco City workers will be rallying at San Francisco City Hall to demand an end to continued concession demands by the City and County of San Francisco. The rally will take place at 5:30 p.m. at San Francisco City Hall. On Tuesday, May Day, workers and labor supporters will be meeting in front of SF City Hall at 6 o'clock a.m. and will take buses to the labor rally at the Golden Gate Bridge. The Golden Gate Bridge Labor Coalition will be taking action on May Day. They have been working without a contract for over a year. The management and board of directors wants workers to give up major benefits after concession bargaining. For more information, go to Facebook and search Occupy the Bridge. Also on Tuesday, May Day, CNA and NU nurses will be striking at Peralta Bates Sutter Hospital in Berkeley. They have been without a contract, and the Sutter management wants the nurses to make major concessions on their health care. They are asking for support on their picket lines. For more information, visit nationalnursesunited.org. On Tuesday at 11 o'clock a.m., SCIU 87 janitors without a contract at the Westfield Center will be rallying. The center is across the street from Powell and Market Streets in San Francisco. There will also be rallies in Oakland sponsored by Occupy Oakland. For more information, go to strikemayfirst.com. That's strikemay, the letter 1, st.com. There will be May Day rallies around Northern California, so make May Day a day for all working people. If you have events for the labor calendar, send them to info@workweekradio.org. This is Erica Lucarati with Workweek Radio.
You are listening to PRN.FM, the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Jim Menzel Joseph, host of the Art of Survival show on the Progressive Radio Network. Together, we will share a journey of discovery and a vision of creating a sustainable future for ourselves and for our planet. Tune in Sundays, 3 p.m. Eastern, or catch us on the archives 24/7. If you like the show, rate us on iTunes. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you are coming with us.
Hi, I'm Karen Hartglass, the host of It's All About Food. Join me every Wednesday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, where we talk about my favorite subject, food. Learn how you can make a positive difference in your life and all life on Earth every time you eat. To listen to the show, go to prn.fm. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you are coming with us.
Hi, this is Professor T. Love of Ebola Soul, a mixed stew of soul music. Come get your history lesson in soul music on Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern. Ow. Tune in as I play soul music from 1949 to the present. Also, listen to Ebola Soul in the archives. If you like Ebola Soul, rate us in iTunes. Come and catch a groove on Ebola Soul. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Oh, Jeff.
Yes, Lee?
I just want you to know.
What?
You occupy my heart.
Aw.
Cheater on the Rude with Jeff Chrysler
and Lee Papa. Thursdays, 8 p.m. Eastern. Check out our old shows on the archives.
Archives? That sounds like some weird yellow moldy paper stuff.
And you can listen to all of our old moldy shows at PRN.FM.
Did you hear the Progressive Radio Network has a new slogan?
It does.
It does. Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you are coming with us.
That sounds sort of progressive.
It does, it does, but I think it needs to be a little more demanding.
Progressive Radio Network is moving forward!
And we want you to come
with us.
Hi, I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And I'm registered nurse Vicki Saputo. We hope you'll join us on our new time slot for our live call-in talk show, Prescriptions for Health, on PRN.FM and DrSaputo.com on Mondays at 1 p.m. Eastern Time and 10 a.m. Pacific Standard Time.
Sometimes a fever's not a bad thing.
Dreaming is really important to our health.
Laughter's the best medicine.
We should use our common sense.
If you miss our live show, you can always catch us on PRN.FM and DrSaputo.com archives.
Also, if you like our show, please rate us on iTunes.
The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
This is PRN.FM. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today's program, we've been looking at the impact of the Deepwater Horizon disaster and British Petroleum. We've been looking at how it's impacted health over 2 years past that disaster. We just heard an interview with Dar Shamail, and we will now be joined by investigative journalist Antonia Juhas about her most recent reporting published in The Nation magazine. She recently did an article titled 2 years After the BP Spill, A Hidden Health Crisis Festers. You can learn more about Antonia Juhas at antoniajuhas.com. She is a leading oil industry expert, a policy analyst, author and activist. She's the author of three books, most recently Black Tide. She also is, I mentioned, writing from The Nation magazine with funding provided by the Investigative Fund for The Nation Institute, and is an associate fellow with the Institute for Policy Studies, among many, many other things. Antonia Juhas, thanks so much for taking time out of your schedule to join us on this important subject today.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
So let's start out. You've been investigating this for some time. Clearly, you've been writing about the problems of the oil industry for a very long time. You're now looking at BP's toxic legacy. Can you talk to us a little bit about the research, the process, and your findings?
Sure. As you said, been covering this disaster since it began, and immediately knew right away upon getting to the ground in the Gulf that this was a tragedy that was going to require much more than just a few stops in the Gulf to know what was happening. Obviously, we knew from the start that it was a serious problem, but we didn't know how great it was until the realization came that the oil industry had absolutely no idea how to stop a deep water blowout. And so it continued and continued. But in addition to the amount of oil, there was the multiple obstacles put in place of journalists to try and cover the disaster. I mean, literally, we'd be stopped by police and private security, not allowed to go to beaches. We'd be told that we'd be fined $60,000 or face going to jail if we went towards into the water where oil was. We weren't allowed to go into aircraft to fly over the spill, and just multiple barriers. So I knew that this was going to be a long road of coverage, and so I stuck it out and luckily had a publisher, Wiley Publishers, that wanted to publish a book on the topic, and then have been very fortunate with outlets such as the Progressive Magazine, on which I also have the cover article this month, and the Nation Investigative Institute, which funded the research that I did to uncover the ongoing health crisis as well.
Antonia, hi, this is Peter Phillips. Welcome to the Project Censored Show.
Hi, Peter. Good morning.
Yeah. I see just by Googling your name that you've been on FAIR over the years, Democracy Now!, certainly the Huffington Post, and now you're on the front cover of The Nation magazine. Sounds like The Progressive as well. I saw that you did one interview on MSNBC recently, and has other corporate media in the U.S. Address this story, or what's really happening with this? I mean, it's devastating what's happened to the people in the Gulf, and hundreds of thousands of people are impacted. How is corporate media dealing with this?
Well, I think everyone will remember when the oil, First, of course, you know, 11 men died when the Deepwater Horizon, when the explosions happened on the Deepwater Horizon. And when the oil was gushing from the Macondo well below it, I think we'll all remember that there was tons of media coverage. And if you look at polls, people even wanted more coverage than they were getting, even though it was for the length that the gusher happened, the one of the most covered major tragedies in the United States history for the amount of media coverage that it received. Even when it was receiving this enormous portion of the media market, Americans wanted to see even more coverage than they got. And there was a flood of reporters down in the Gulf. And for the residents of the Gulf, this all felt way too familiar. They had experienced the same thing after Katrina. And what they were all very afraid of was that this wave of media coverage would happen, and their expectations would get very high, that the coverage would then turn into action. Policy action, action among policymakers, action among activists and the rest of the country, and their hopes would get up, and then that wouldn't really happen, and that the media coverage wouldn't be sustained, and the subsequent action that you hope comes in response to the media wouldn't come. And that happened again in response to the Deepwater Horizon. Basically, when the Obama administration got up on television, and there was a slew of them that got up on television in mid-August of 2010, and announced that the majority of the oil is gone from the Gulf, when in fact the exact opposite was true. TV coverage turned off, the public turned off, the media all went away, and had already started going away when the well was capped. And that was really the end of the focused media coverage. And it was also the end of policymakers' attention. It was also the end, really, of the broader attention of most of the mainstream environmental organizations. And people across the Gulf have felt, you know, let down by all of those all of those bodies, the media, excuse me, the policymakers, and in many ways the activist community as well.
We're speaking with Antonia Yuhas about a recent article in the cover of Nation magazine, 2 years after the BP spill, a hidden health crisis festers. This is certainly a PR coup for BP. Again, they really managed to scrub themselves from a lot of this, and now with this recent settlement case, again, making it appear as though that they're really trying to clean up after their mess in the Gulf. Your article, of course, your article is heart-wrenching, by the way. I strongly encourage people to read it. Let's talk about some of the actual human costs here that BP is ignoring, and fortunately, people like yourself and Dar Jamal are covering, so people can find out what's going on there. Can you talk to us a little bit about the article and again, some of the human cost and the people and what's going on there?
Yeah, let me just back up on a few pieces that you just laid out. And the first thing is, you know, Dar, as I'm sure he just laid out, has been covering this case for 2 years, incredibly embedded within the communities most impacted. And I double your encouragement of people to see what he's read and follow his work. First, BP has an enormous greenwash, but just to uncover what BP has done a little bit, in response to the Exxon Valdez disaster in Alaska, the Congress acted and the president acted, and that was President George Bush Sr. And they passed an incredible piece of legislation, the Oil Pollution Act, in the wake of that disaster. Comparatively, not a single piece, not one, of legislation has passed in the wake of this dramatically larger oil spill, dramatically larger. This was the size of one Exxon Valdez every 4 days for 87 days. But that piece of legislation required BP to do a host of things, which BP has done, not because BP is a nice, happy company and wants to, you know, do good things, but because it's required to by legislation. And it's been required to stop the spill, clean up the oil, and pay economic restitution and provide restoration for the environment and economic loss. And so we've seen BP put out a lot of money, and that's why. We've also seen BP put out an enormous amount of PR, and it's been incredibly successful in that. Its commercials play, you know, on a loop, and they have convinced the American public that everything is gone, everything is fine. And they've been supported in that contention by the Obama administration, which has also been very eager to see this disaster go away as quickly as possible, because the president simply didn't want to be tarred with this disaster as he worked on other things and also continues to, in many areas, court the oil industry. The reality is that BP has done some very good work in the Gulf, but not nearly enough, and has at the same time lied about its success. And in that, again, it's not only supported by the Obama administration, it's supported by the entire oil industry. So it's not just been BP alone. It's been the entire oil industry trying to get out the story that this was a fluke incident and that it only impacted one oil company and that everything is fine. And those three messages have basically been thoroughly adopted by the American public, although none of them are true.
No, I was just going to add to that simply that the amount of money that BP has been spending on tourism advertising, and you know, you see people in HuffPo and a number of other publications of people bragging about eating the seafood and these kind of things, and Darwin and, you know, details about the problems with the sea life there. So again, it is, as you stated, it's amazing how their main points have really stuck overall.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, part of that, too, is that they were required under the Oil Pollution Act to put in money towards tourism. So it's this double-edged sword that we want people to know the areas where the Gulf is safe. That is important. This is five states, an economy that is based on seafood and tourism, and it's a beautiful area, an incredibly gorgeous part of the country. The beaches are outstandingly beautiful. And there are places where you can go in the Gulf, and we don't want to send a message, which is that this is, you know, a black, stained, tarred portion of the country. That's not true. But we have to simultaneously acknowledge the fact that there continues to be oil on the beaches, continues to be people who are sick, which we will discuss, continues to be oil in the water, at the same time as there are still clean beaches and there is still clean water and there are still healthy people. But unless we acknowledge the darker part, we'll never get to the restoration and the recovery that'll bring us to the more totally to the green and healthy part and safe part.
Antonia, you talk about 194,000 individuals have now accepted one-time final payments from BP. This is 2 years afterwards, yet this oil could linger for decades and have health impacts forever, or certainly forever in terms of a single lifetime. These people are accepting $5,000, $10,000, and then agreeing not to ever sue BP again, or that's a final settlement. Is this fair? The long-term health impacts could be quite substantial. Are they quickly jumping in, offering people $5,000 and saying, go away?
It's utterly not fair, and I would argue that it's illegal. What happened in the wake of this spill, 210 million gallons of oil, 2 million gallons of a toxic chemical dispersant were released. In addition, oil was burned. For 410 burns took place over 3 months on the surface of the ocean. The result is what one doctor I interviewed, Dr. James Diaz, called a toxic gumbo of chemicals to which the people of the Gulf were and continue to be exposed. The realities of that exposure are sadly very predictable. Oil is toxic. It is a toxin. The chemicals that are in the dispersant are toxins. They were heavily applied to the people and places and wildlife of the Gulf, and those people and places are demonstrating the expected outcome to that exposure, and that includes acute symptoms, shorter term symptoms. There's something called the BP rash, which is a itchy red rash that people get. Something called the BP moment, which is forgetfulness, a fogginess in their brain. There are coughs and nosebleeds. And then there are what are already becoming persistent problems. So children are suffering persistent bronchial problems all across the Gulf, such that, you know, the nebulizer has become the, you know, item that all the children are bringing to school. Instead of the, you know, My Little Pony, it's a nebulizer that everybody has with them all across the Gulf. And what we're seeing is, as the more persistent problems are impacting communities that were more likely to have them. So if you're if you combine where you live, you are close to the Gulf, and you're a child, you're more susceptible to the toxins in the air. If you live near the Gulf and you have a pre-existing health condition, if you were more heavily exposed. So I worked closely on this article with the Government Accountability Project, which is in the process of putting out a report on whistleblowers, which are people who were involved in the cleanup of the beach and just were so ill-treated by BP that they were heavily and wrongfully exposed to oil and chemicals in ways that they shouldn't have been. They're experiencing horrible health problems. And so we're seeing even more extreme health problems already starting to emerge, people bleeding constantly from their rectum, from their ears, from their noses, people from breath, obviously an indication of breast cancer. I interviewed one woman whose husband, who he couldn't speak to me because he can no longer communicate, had gotten his dream job as a beach cleaner in Florida, and he was the guy who walked along the beach and picked up trash and picked up whatever came on the beach. He fixed the bathrooms, whatever needed to happen. He loved this job. He was doing this job before and then after the oil spill, but after the oil spill, it meant cleaning up oiled products, oiled material. And she said he was just constantly covered in the stuff when he'd come home. His clothes smelled of oil. Sometimes she'd just throw them away.
He was. We're almost out of time.
I'm sorry.
This story, I think, is important because he's all the way over in Florida.
That's right. He's all the way over Florida, and my interviews cover us. You know, basically go along the Gulf, and he's all the way over in Florida.
So they're really, when you say, is there safe places in the Gulf? From Florida to certainly Louisiana, probably even Texas, there really isn't.
No, there are unsafe places all across the Gulf, and there are safe places all across the Gulf. In terms of going to visit, there is the potential exposure over these last 2 years was all along the Gulf, but that doesn't mean that level of exposure persists today.
And we don't really have that full information, correct? I mean, we've got, you know, millions of gallons of oil spread all over. Most of it's still there, according to DAR. And this is going to be an ongoing, continuing problem. It needs a massive amount of research and support.
Certainly. Absolutely. Absolutely true. Just to say that the end of what happened with Keith, he started reporting serious headaches, and then within a year has been diagnosed with full-on multifarc dementia, which is one of the most extreme forms of dementia. He is no longer able to communicate. He's violent with his wife. He's basically gone from being healthy and strong to a prediction that he will his life expectancy is only 5 years.
Antonio, I'm sorry to interrupt.
Yeah.
We're out of time,
okay.
But I apologize. This story is incredibly important. Please encourage people to go online. You can go to darjamal.net. You can go to antoniojuhas.org. Is it org or com?
Easier would be black-tide.org.
Great. Black-tide.org. Thanks so much for your very important work. We're definitely going to want to have you back on to talk about this and follow up on it. Again, thanks so much for your courage to be there and report these stories.
And this Nation magazine article that's come out this week should be one seen by millions of people in this country for sure.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We have a few quick announcements today. Dennis Bernstein will be speaking at 2969 Mission Street in San Francisco about his new book, Special Ed: Voices from the Hidden Classroom. That's tomorrow, Saturday, April 28th at 5 p.m. Also, there are a number of events going on in the Bay Area upcoming for May Day. You can learn more about OccupyOakland.org or OccupyTogether.org for events in your area. Peter?
And there's a big International Workers Day Unite for Economic Justice and Immigrant Rights in Santa Rosa this next May 1st, Tuesday, starting at 3:30 at the old Albertsons parking lot at 665 Sebastopol Road. The march will be over to Juilliard Park at 4:30 and then go on there into the evening. And we're quite sure that that's going to be a very large, large group.
Okay, next week we're going to be in KPFA Fun Drive mode. We'll be doing a special show on the May 4th Kent State shootings. Please join us for that. Apologies to those of you we couldn't get announcements in because we're out of time today. Thanks to Kirsten Thomas and Anthony Fest. We'll see you next time.